New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and it's great to have you with us on the program. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time, streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are rebroadcast on A2Zen.fm on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, and we also archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. It's a lot of information that I have to remember when I do these programs to let you know how you can get more information. But we are certainly glad that you are with us, and we encourage you to join us every week. Go to our guests' websites as well as get information. Many of our guests have materials that are free to you for the downloading, for the viewing, and so forth. So please check it out. We have a very special guest on the program today, and we're going to kind of continue a conversation, not so much with this guest, because this is the first time she's been on the program, but talking about sound therapy, talking about different aspects of music and vibration, tones, and so on and so on. And we're going to do that with our special guest. She is a musician in her own right, Alisa Brown, and we want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I very much appreciate it.
Well, this is rather extraordinary because of the music that you create and write and perform, but also because of the knowledge that you have in terms of we talked about this, of course, before we decided to do this interview, and just in general conversation. Because this has come up in other interviews with people when we start talking about music, when we start talking about vibration and tones and so forth. And, of course, a lot of different topics were thrown out at the time of our conversation. We're going to talk a little bit about the Mozart effect, what it is, what it isn't, as well as is there a Chopin equivalency, if you will, or Bach or Brahms or Tchaikovsky method, if you will, in terms of those types of things. So we'll talk more about that. But let's talk a little bit about your music career and in terms of the type of music, maybe that's one place. And I know that it's very difficult for people who are working within what would be considered along the lines of a spiritual and or slash metaphysical circles. They don't like to be defined, and it's hard to define because it's different. It's not something that people can label. So share with us from your observation, your perspective, what kind of music is it that you present?
Well, that's a really wonderful question because you're right. It's incredibly difficult to answer. My background is as a classically trained singer, and I went to the Cleveland Institute of Music, and I studied the classical bel canto singing, and started out doing a lot of work in singing Baroque music, Bach, and then, of course, Mozart being one of my favorites. I'd come from Texas, so my family loves country western, and they thought that I was an alien, so they couldn't figure out why I wasn't singing, on the Grand Ole Opry versus wanting to get into the Grand Opera. So my background is as a standard straight up singer. I did a lot of musical theater. I've done a lot of Spanish musical theater called Zarzuela. I've done a lot of chamber music, but throughout my career, it always appeared as though the performances that were the most meaningful for me were always for the disenfranchised. So, for example, when I made my New York debut with the New York Bach Aria Society, it was in the middle of a blizzard, and so the concert couldn't be canceled. We were already there, but nobody could get in other than the homeless people. And so my New York debut was to street people in a beautiful concert setting down at NYU. And they were delightful. They were so grateful, and I truly felt as though the music that we were singing, which was all Bach, was connecting with them. It was really a heavenly moment and very inspirational. So when I think of the type of music that I perform, I'm always mindful of the message that I'm communicating, not necessarily the lyrics. The lyrics have, always, for me, always have to have a very good message, even if it's expressing something of sadness, but it has to be sincere. But I develop an internal message through the power of intention and the intent so that the story is true to me. I don't divulge the story, but it is so true to me, and I do it with sincerity, this is my intention, that the listener is moved to a story that is sincere and real to him or her. And so it becomes a personal connection between the performer and the artist, and the audience. It, in a way, it's a form of entrainment, because entrainment is really where the listener becomes starts to feel the message of that music and connects with either the composer or the performer or both. So I started doing this musical recipes for peace, health, and well-being back before I even knew that there was such a thing. And as my career developed, I started doing more and more work to raise monies for orphanages, for the United Nations, for UNESCO. My Carnegie Hall debut was for the New York Women's Ensemble and Music for Life to raise monies and awareness for Children of the Night, which is a not-for-profit out of Los Angeles that's rescued over 10,000 children from child prostitution since 1979. So it's really run the gamut from some little club things where we raise some money here and there. I always try to donate something back to major events such as that. And I debuted my latest album for World Peace Day. The UN invited me, and I went over to China, and I debuted my album there. And I sang two songs that I don't believe would have been allowed without the UN, seal of approval, and also the Chinese government. I sang an arrangement of the Bach Gounod Ave Maria that I created with my co-arranger, Barry Goldstein, who's a renowned sound healer and Grammy winner. And then I sang another song based on a Taoist meditation, which is the most one of the more sacred meditations in the Tao, T-A-O, they pronounce it Tao. I found out there because I was saying Tao, and it probably meant carburetor. They didn't know what I was saying. Because, boy, if you mispronounce a word, it's 100% wrong, and they just look at you like, huh? But this song was on the Khan and Lee meditation, but this is world music, so it's inspiring world music, and for me personally, it has the intention of healing, as a healing message, as one who's listening to it needs to receive. It's not for me to determine. I do work with a renowned sound healer, so when we create this music or these two albums that we've worked on together, hopefully, and we're working on some more projects, we set the intention of the album, and we create a journey, and we create a mission. When you were talking about the Mozart effect, it's really interesting because that started out, and you can stop me if I'm just rattling on. I apologize.
No, you're doing fine.
There was a French researcher by the name of Alfred Tomatis, and he wrote a book called Pourquoi Mozart? Now, that was the precursor to the Mozart Effect paper that was issued in Nature magazine 2 years later. And what his paper was talking about was retraining the ear, because he thought that listening to Mozart's music at differing frequencies helped the ear and promoted healing and the development of the brain. So these three other researchers said, well, now that's a nifty idea. And this is hilarious because Pythagoras figured this out back in like 535 B.C. But anyway, three other researchers by the name of Rauscher, Shaw, and Kai came up with what they called the Mozart effect. And by having a control group, so those people didn't have any music, and another group listening to this Mozart sonata, a piano sonata, and what they found was that it, this repetitive, and another group listened to repetitive relaxation music, and another group didn't listen to anything. So what they found and what they actually stated was that the effect is limited to spatial temporal tasks involving mental imagery and temporal ordering. And you're like, oh, what is that? Well, that means how you see stuff and organize things. So that's pretty amazing, and it was a short-term effect, but there was evidence to that effect. So what happened was this music columnist for the New York Times named Alex Ross wrote a really kind of a lighthearted article saying, oh, you know, these guys, they found that they've determined that listening to Mozart actually makes you smarter, and presented this paper as the final piece to as evidence that Mozart has dethroned Beethoven as the world's greatest composer. Well, the media just went nuts with that, and so did a lot of people saying, "Oh my, you know, here's proof that the Mozart effect works." Well, in fact, it's the music effect. It doesn't have to be Mozart at all. And so it could be Chopin, it could be Bach, it could be the Beatles. There's now research since then, we're talking 20 years hence, that goes back to verify what the ancients knew back, you know, like I said, at the time of Pythagoras and the Greeks. But it's so interesting because that little paper sparked so much interest in sound healing. Ultrasound and what have you had come back into favor in around the 1930s when they figured that the sound could, for whatever reason, destroy kidney stones and shrink tumors, but they didn't know why. And it didn't have the mechanism to figure that out. They just knew it empirically or anecdotally. They would, through observation. But they didn't have the actual science behind it. And when you think about the brain science, unless you're doing some sort of scan or something like that, you really can't take out a slice of brain, desiccate it, and then put it under a microscope because it's dead. So you know, what do you do with that? So a lot of the studies that came out after that were saying, oh, no, these guys were wrong. It doesn't do anything. And the one that just slayed me, this is the kind of stuff I do for fun. I like going sitting around reading this stuff. So, but the thing that really got me was this paper called Prelude or Requiem for the Mozart Effect. And these two researchers in 1999 named Chabris and Steele said, oh, there's a simple neuropsychological explanation for this. It's called enjoyment arousal. So it's like, okay, you mean you like what you hear, and it activates the brain. I really think that's probably a good thing. So, you know, but they're poo-pooing the whole Mozart effect. But, in fact, what they were doing was driving more research to be done on this. So, you know, what happened is that this empirical, anecdotal research started to surface in the psychiatric realms. So as you look at, say, and you go into the archives of psychiatric nursing and stuff, you know, you've got all these people in nursing homes who are you know, really depressed, and or they suffer with disabilities, and you've got others that, reducing depressive symptoms in adults, and or people who have suffered with Alzheimer's and dementia, you know, just all kinds of awful things. So there's a lot of research there that shows that by listening to this music, when they do these, they do absolute control studies, and they're showing that people's depression is lifted, their heart rates improve, their blood pressure improves, their sense of personal power, that they feel better about themselves, improves. And what they found is that there's no difference between the music of Mozart or music provided by the Psychiatric Institute or for these tests, and music that is selected by the patients or their family members who said, you know, Grandpa used to love, you know, Cab Calloway kind of a thing. So it was the psychiatric community that started to recognize music's effect on empirically, because they really couldn't take any brain scans, but they just saw it in people's behavior. So, you know, you fast forward and you start getting books written by Oliver Sacks, you know, Musicophilia, and Daniel Levitin, who wrote This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of the Human Obsession. And he has developed what's called the Levitin Effect, which demonstrates that long-term memory preserves many of the details of musical experience than previously thought. So it's amazing. And that book is now, his book is actually required reading at Harvard for people who study neuroscience and music. It's a phenomenal book. It's really incredibly well written.
Well, what's interesting, too, throw this in there, on a political level, it looks like the former mayor, governor of Georgia, Zell Miller, Back in 1998, he proposed in his state budget $105,000 a year to provide every child born in Georgia with a CD or tape of classical music. Obviously, he was aware of something there, and he even played this for the legislature. He played Ode to Joy, and basically the quote here is, "Now, don't you feel smarter already?" Well, when you listen to Ode to Joy, I don't know about intelligence, but it certainly makes you feel pretty darn good when you start listening to that.
Oh, it's beautiful. And, you know, they're just, the ancients knew all of this. You know, they had figured it out. I mean, like when I keep saying Pythagoras, the Greeks, look, they said that harmony is recognized as the immediate prerequisite to beauty. That's how they looked at harmony. Mm-hmm. But because he was a mathematician, he was interested in the mathematical components of harmony, because to him, math was harmonious. So he, while not a musician, he was very interested in music, and because of Pythagoras, he discovered the diatonic scale. And he's like, well, what is that? That's do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. And so that's the, it's a octave repeating a scale, you know, progressive scale with five whole notes and two half notes. For people who don't know, just think of do a deer. So why would that be important? Well, that's important because it helps musicians to tune their instruments so people can tune and play together and play music in the same way. Well, you know, he felt that music was so harmonious and had such a powerful effect on people, and that certain scales, they called them modes, would have a certain effect. And music was integral to the life of the Greeks. So much so that, you know, that governor down there in Georgia didn't have anything on Plato, because he thought that music was more than just, you know, creating cheerful, agreeable stuff and that, you know, pleasure response or what have you. He felt that music should make us have a love for all that's noble and to hate, you know, anything that's mean, and nothing could be, well, he didn't think that anything could more strongly influence our feelings more than melody and rhythm. And he even suggested to the legislature at that time that they outlaw certain types of music, you know, if they were too enervating, because he felt that it would destroy the very state itself. So this was really powerful stuff at the time.
Yeah.
And, it wasn't just the Greeks. You know, the Aborigines in Australia felt that music sound was what organized matter. And so their instrument was called the didgeridoo, which are yakani, I think is what it's called. I'm sorry, I can't remember. I just think of it as the didgeridoo.
Right.
But they used that for healing, for bones and joints and what have you. And so it was pretty amazing stuff that they were doing. And so the concept of music and sound forming matter turned into something that I've looked into called cymatics. And cymatics is basically showing how sound can cause shapes and matter to form, to organize matter. So this is where you start getting into music and healing, and these other studies that have been done, you know, that shows that you've got this doctor named, I don't know if I can even say it. It's a James Jimczewski, and he's a Nobel Prize-winning scientist out of UCLA. And he created something called sonocytology, which is just an amazing, amazing thing. What he did, I want to see if I can find that in my little notes here, because I want to make sure I read it correctly. It's
sure.
Amazing.
Well,
here we are. I got it.
All right. I was going to say too that what's interesting when you start talking about this, and I shift over into television just a little bit here for the example, on a very popular program that's airing here in 2012-2013, called The Big Bang Theory. There was an episode. There was a scene in the show where the four scientists, the four physicists or what have you, were standing around this speaker that they had covered with plastic to protect it, because what they had that they had poured into the cone of the speaker on top of this plastic was a mixture of water and baking soda. Then they turned on the sound, and it was a low bass sound, and you could actually this was not a CGI. This really happens.
It really happens.
The baking soda mixed with the water and the vibrations from the music they were using, the low tones, caused this material, the two elements, to appear as if they were solid and were jumping up and down on this speaker cone, again,
that's
lined
correct.
With plastic so they didn't ruin the speaker cone. So, I mean, and I'm thinking, okay, those were the bass tones. And, of course, we hear this when we're driving around. We'll have somebody drive up alongside us who's got the bass cranked up on their vehicle.
Sure.
And you can't stand it in your car. I can only imagine what it must be like inside the rolled up windows of the car that's playing it. And if the vibrations of that low tone are doing that to baking soda and water, per that example, I can only imagine what that's doing to the interior, internal organs of the person who's enmeshed right in it, and we're irritated, like I said, and we're a car over.
Absolutely. Well, with the Big Bang Theory, that's called cymatics, and the pictures or the figures, the sound figures that they make are called cymoglyphs, and this was something that a Swiss scientist named Dr. Hans Jenny discovered, but it had been around before, but he figured out that he used these various powders and pastes and liquids that would respond to the effects of sound. So now they do a type of a sound healing with cymatics because they're able to make certain frequencies to penetrate in a certain area to reshape that particular organ or tumor or what have you. And that brings you back to this other thing, which is just so amazing to me, was this Dr. Jim Zevsky of UCLA, because this goes right back to that bass tone and being so loud and obnoxious. He revolutionized this in, I think it was 2004, and I don't know why this didn't make it all over the world press. But what he did was he used a kind of a super sensitive microphone. It's called an atomic force microscope. And what he did was he mapped the pulsations of the cell's outer membranes, and he identified the song of the cell. And his work has revealed that every cell in our bodies has a unique sonic signature and sings to its neighbors. So talk about a Mozart effect. All music has an effect.
Wow.
And isn't that amazing? Did you see that on the front page of the New York Times?
I don't get the Times, but nonetheless, that's extraordinary. I, as a child growing up, would use moaning as a form, if not to help myself to at least feel a little bit better, as my mother described to my sister when they walked into my bedroom while I was lying there moaning, suffering from the flu. My sister said, "Mom, make her stop. He sounds terrible." To which she said, "No, that's how he heals himself."
Absolutely. Well, music played at lower registers reduces tension. That's absolutely proven. That's for sure. And music that's played at, I'd say, 80 to 90 beats per minute increases your tension, and music played at 40 to 60 beats per minute decreases tension. All of those things are absolutely true. And there's been studies done by a French, he calls himself a bioengineerist. His name is something Mammon, M-A-M-A-N. I apologize, I don't remember all of this stuff offhand. But what he did was where he's been able to take cancer patients and figure out a frequency for them to intone, say for 3.5 hours. I remember one of the studies that he did to intone, and these tumors were either reduced or went away altogether. And that he found that if you used the Ionian scale, which is C D E F G A B C D E, it's a 9-tone scale, and he used a xylophone. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And those cells would implode because they couldn't handle that frequency. What he did is he played a frequency with which they could not resonate. And so they were destroyed. Then he used the human voice, and it only took 7 minutes, 7 or 9 minutes, something like that. And that's because the human voice is so powerful because it has consciousness in it.
Mm.
And also it carries the phi ratio, which is the golden mean. And so that is pure harmony. It's harmonious in all of nature, that phi ratio, and the voice carries it with those sacred sounds and intoning and what have you.
Wow.
And so healthy cells respond with getting healthier. Sick cells respond by imploding. They're destroyed. This is the theory in any case, especially with this Dr. Jim Zebski, because what they're looking at for what he's doing, and I wasn't able to find any more research because I actually went online over the weekend. I thought, I need to see what all he's done. But it could be that they're just waiting to publish papers. But since they've identified the sound of healthy cells versus those of unhealthy ones or cells that are hurting us, they're thinking that they might be able to play the destructive sounds of these rogue cells back to them, but greatly amplified.
Wow.
So that they implode and are destroyed. And so in that scenario, there'd be no collateral damage to surrounding cells, since the healthy cells wouldn't resonate with those frequencies.
No, you have given us so much information just in this first 20-25 minutes of the program, and we're going to come back and talk more about this, all right?
Okay.
All right. We're talking with Alisa Brown, and we're also going to play some of her music here in just a little bit in our second segment with her as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're making as much noise as we can to help your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay with us.
Tell me your story.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we are talking about sound and music and its effects. And I have to tell you, Alisa Brown, who is our guest, an accomplished a vocal musician in her own right. You've mentioned so many things, especially in the last 5 minutes of the last segment that we were talking. At that, it's like the questions just are flowing out, and it's almost like I almost have to leave those. I've got to set those aside. Because I want to talk about something that is available on your website. You have some music files, you have some videos, but in particular, you have something that I was really intrigued by that you can hear as we are talking here. And the name of this, and I'm going to have you share with us what this is all about, it's called the Ave Maria Experience. Take a listen. It may be sacrilege to interrupt this piece of music, Alisa, but it's extraordinary that you have put something like this together. Tell us what this is all about, because first of all, it's different, because you do not hear an up-tempo beat when you hear most versions of this song.
No. This came about, The story of how this album actually came about is that this is more on the esoteric New Thought platform of my life. I was doing some work, and some things didn't turn out as I had hoped, and I had some difficulties in my personal life, and it was at a crossroads, and I was confused, and I didn't know what to do or which direction to, which road to go down in my musical journey. So I knew I wanted to do something out of the bell curve of mediocrity. I wanted to get out of the status quo and really take a chance. So I asked for guidance, and I asked for guidance and to get. I wanted a sign, and I wanted it to be big. I said, "Please think big." My exact words: "Think big and make this a divine collaboration," because I want to work with people who are like-minded, who want to be of service to others through the art and serve the art, not the art serve them. It's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a workshop as it were, just turned up that same day that I asked for guidance, and I said, okay, I guess this is it. And Barry Goldstein was teaching the workshop, and I didn't know anything about him, but he was teaching a sound healing workshop, and I thought, well, you know, I've heard of that Jonathan Goldman guy. He's, like, hugely famous. What did I know? And I, you know, I've read up on stuff, so, you know, I'll go listen to this guy. He's in town. And I walk in, and, you know, he's got a guitar, and, you know, here I'm a classical musician, and he's got a guitar, and, oh, golly, he's going to, you know, you're like, oh, we're going to strum a couple of notes and sing Kumbaya. Oh, God, this is going to be terrible. And he was just fabulous. He was just great. So he just, he really was just great. It is a wonderful workshop, and I enjoyed it. It was a couple of days long, and I, at the end, I really felt rejuvenated. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, I should really study this a little bit more, hence my knowledge base. It started, my big quest for figuring things out started at that time, even though I'd had a interest before, but nothing like this.
Mm-hmm.
So a friend of mine had gotten some of my demo CDs, the crummy ones that I made in the basement, you know, I really didn't think about it, and said, you ought to listen to these, you know, Elise is a singer. And so he did. He put them on, and I said, well, they're not really very well done. And he said, well, you have a really beautiful voice, and perhaps we could work together. And I said, how? You're a rock and roll folk guitarist. And at which point my friend said, he won a Grammy for producing Les Paul's 2005 Freedom Special. The guy is an amazing musician. Be humble. Just listen to what he has to say. And I'm like, oh, boy. So I said, what do you do? You have a studio or something? And he said, yes, Think Big. And I said, what do you mean, Think Big? And he said, that's the name of my studio, Think Big. I'd really like to work with you. I think it'll be a divine collaboration. And, ooh. And I'm, you know, it was, you know, one of those, you should have had a V8 moment.
Yeah.
Like, there's your sign, whatever.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, there you go. So what happened was, I went into New York to the Music Building, which is an iconic building in the city, you know, and I was very nervous. All of a sudden, he went from this, like, nebbishy little guy playing guitar to he's a Grammy winner, you know. And so I went to his studio, and he shares the suite with, Kelly Minucci, who's on my latest CD, and he's won Emmys for everything. And, you know, he's phenomenal musicians, everybody, so I just kind of, like, backed into the room. And Barry said, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. And he says, what's your favorite song? And I said, Ave Maria. And he said, Ave Maria? He said, I'm a little Jewish guy. What do you mean, Ave Maria? Said, you know, Ave Maria, Ave Maria. You know, he goes, that one? You want to do that one? Okay. You know, why? And I said, I've sung it thousands of times, and it always touches my heart. It's in the key of F, and it feels very heart-centered. And I think it's just gorgeous, and I want to do it. That's what I want to start with. So we figured we'd do 10 songs, right? 10 different songs like you do on an album. And he said, okay, go home and write it. And you know, write out all the choral parts and what you want to do. And, you know, we're going to co-write this together. Okay. So I did. And but Barry doesn't read music, so it's a little problematic. And he's a pop musician, and I'm classical. So we had absolutely nothing in it. We could not communicate. We were speaking Chinese to Greek, and truly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to pray. And I mean, really, we had to meditate. And then I had to learn how to read Pro Tools, because he wasn't going to learn how to read scores in my music. So we started with this one song. Only I wrote out so much stuff that we had a couple more versions. And then we had a few more versions, and then we had another couple of versions, and then all of a sudden we had 10 versions, and it came from one song. That was never our intention, to create 10 songs. They created themselves.
Well, you know, and the old theory, you know, you plan, God laughs.
That's right. That's right. So that's right. You plan, God laughs. So he was really big sense of humor there, and so we decided, well, why not? You know, this is a Mother of the Light, and so this is called Ave Maria. The one you've got is As Above, So Below.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we started taking the divine feminine, the aspect of the divine feminine, which actually exists in every culture, and it can be Mother Earth, it can be Shakti, it can be Mary Magdalene, it can be many different things, and so we took out the idea that it was solely a Catholic Christian song, and our intention was that it was calling on the mother, that, you know, everybody had a mother, the mother to help us hear my song.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, hear my prayer. We were asking for a mother's assistance, the way that we would to our own mothers. And the mother, or the parent figure that resides in us, the mother in us to our own children. And so it took on all of these wonderful meanings. And I sing all the vocals, and there's over 100 different vocals on each track, and, you know, in different ways. So I sang the aria itself in an operatic style, and then the chorus had to be sung as angels.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, and these things developed as we were going along. And then we added in tuning forks to really embed these sacred tones.
Right.
And it's in the key of F, which is the heart, heart-centered. And I always see that as the color green. I see music. And so I see that as green and very pastoral and rich and birth. And so then we started in with the various verses and the harmonies, and I brought in a different sense of harmonies than, say, Barry would bring, because my training was classical.
Right.
And so I brought in some peculiar harmonies that he said, you know, well, that's not in keeping with this, or it's dissonant with that, so then we would take it out, but then we'd add something in and inspire us to do something else. And it took us 2 years to create that CD.
Wow. Let me have our listeners hear Mother of the Light. Lisa Brown is the vocal, all of the vocals. She is the vocal on our program as our guest here on the program, and that has to do with the Ave Maria experience. That's extraordinary. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, and as well as the explanation. And you know, I've recorded a few musical cassettes, if you will. I've had people come into my studio back in Phoenix, and again, this was nothing elaborate. I mean, the studio wasn't elaborate. It was my living room and dining room, and the musicians, you know, they weren't professional. They were just people that wanted to create something that they could provide at their service or their performance or what have you. And usually these were religious folks, Christians who had guitars, maybe a tambourine or something like that. But what I noticed was in the process, that the process, no matter how long it took, and yours took 2 years, but I'm going to guess that the majority of those 2 years, you both probably felt like you were in the zone, as the phrase goes.
Oh, absolutely. There were moments that it was like 4 hours. Like, what happened? Oh, I think are we supposed to eat? But I gotta tell you, Barry has a really great sense of humor, and you know, there were really some frustrating moments, because I would say, you know, can we take it at the second system, the pick up to the second system in the B section? And he said, what? And I said, well, and we, you know, I was saying tomato, and he was saying lawnmower. I mean, we just didn't communicate. And I just started crying. I said, I'm about the chattiest person I know, and I could make a conversation with a fence post, and I'm not connecting. And so he started telling me about Puppet G and start speaking in some silly Indian accent, going, "Oh, we're going to do this now," and try to, you know, made me laugh. And then once we realized that it was really funny, and then we started bringing a little bit more lightheartedness into it, because, you know, I was so serious about making something wonderful that we forgot that we were supposed to be having fun.
Exactly.
And you know, then you know, it was a lot of work, and it was really glorious. And when the CD came out, I gave it over to Archbishop Dolan. I hand delivered it. Well, I say I did. My sweet husband did that for me, and he gave it to the music director, Dr. Jennifer Pasquale. At St. Patrick's Cathedral. So she, you know, she calls me up and says, "Oh, he really liked this," and he wrote to me personally. It was very nice, and she said, "You know, what would you like to do?" And I said, "Well, I would really like to sing at St. Patrick's Cathedral." And she said, "Well, that's normally Metropolitan Opera stars." And I said, "Well, that just blows me out of the water. Sorry, that won't be me." And so she said, "Well, would you like to be on, have you on the radio? We have Sirius XM. We have the Catholic Radio. We'll devote an hour to your music." And they did, and it, which was just huge. I was so grateful for that opportunity. And she said, "When your next CD comes out, let us know, and we'll do the same." And they did. So, and knowing full well that we had, you know, the next CD embraces every kind of spirituality and culture and philosophy, and they loved that. So I was really surprised. But I've sung the Ave Maria at Jewish centers, these versions of it, and they love it because they sense that it's talking to the divine feminine that really does exist in all of us, because every man has a feminine side of a nurturing side. Mm-hmm. So it's the nurturer in all of us, and that's what it was all about. And that's the intention that we set into the music, so that, and we didn't start until we got that connection. We just didn't sit down and go, "Okay, let's go to work." You know, we said a prayer, and we sat and we waited, and then we started when we felt, in my way of thinking, that the Holy Spirit was with me. I don't know how Barry felt it, but that was my interpretation. When I felt that I was being divinely inspired, that's when I started. And that's how that CD came about, and the second one, too.
Wow. Now, I know how I have felt when performing in front of people. And it's always been, I've never soloed. It's always been with a group. It's a quartet, or I'm with a chorus. And the quartet is as close as I've gotten to soloing, and I sing, I guess same difference, lead. And so they're going to hear me more than the other guys, but I have to make sure they hear the other guys too, you know. So that was an interesting dynamic for me to learn, but I'm curious, how do you feel? What is, if anything, going through your mind as you are up there, regardless of the audience, large or small, or even in the recording studio? What's going through your mind? What's going through your heart at that time?
Well, that's actually key to everything. When I'm at home or in the studio, whatever I'm doing, I don't practice. I always practice performing. Even if I'm vocalizing, I have an intention. I have a thought. I have a feeling that I want to convey. The body knows how to sing, so I don't need to be gilding the lily by trying to do too much to it. Now, granted, as a classically trained singer, I have to maintain my instrument. But, you know, I can't. It's like you have a cello. You don't put it down between each breath. You know, you got to maintain the structure of the instrument. But I can't hold it. It's kind of like pasta boiling in water. So there's a part of me that's doing that. But I've been singing for so long that I'm monitoring that with one part of my brain. I have to, because you have to think about what you're saying, or you can zone out and not remember. And you will forget the words, no matter how many times you've sung it. Because if you go into what they call a singer's trance, you don't know where you are. And it's terrible. I've had it happen years ago. I thought it was just a lie. It is not. And it's not fair to the audience, but it's terrifying for the singer, because all of a sudden you think, God's going to strike me down, I'll have a heart attack, and everybody will feel sorry for me. No, that's not going to happen. They'll ask for their money back, and you won't get a job. So you can't really do that one. So what I prepare, I visualize myself already performing before I ever get to the concert hall. So I've got it in my mind that I've walked in, I've put on my makeup, I've gotten my gown, I've rehearsed already, I've already walked out, I've already done it. Because anything that's vividly imagined, the subconscious mind doesn't take a joke, and the mind doesn't really recognize the difference between a vivid imagination and reality, so I've already done it. Now, I'm excited. I will never tell you that I'm not nervous about performing, because, you know, stuff happens. You know, you're going to have phlegm. I sang it in China and it, for 10,000 people, and I was supposed to sing at 11 in the morning, and at 9:05, I just zipped up my gown, and they said, "Oh, Evisa, you sing now." What? And I hadn't even warmed up, so I'm running through these people going, you know, whatever I can do to get, you know, my voice kind of warmed up. And, you know, these poor little Chinese people are thinking, oh, it's a crazy redhead, oh my God. So, and then I walked on stage, and all of a sudden the heavens opened up and it started raining. So, you know, I'm like, well, I don't think I'll be electrocuted because I'm holding a microphone. So, you know, but I've practiced so much. I have done this so many times that my body remembers, and I have that muscle memory. But more than that, this music is extremely powerful, and it's a blessing to be able to share it, but it's a tremendous responsibility. And I feel that I would be cheating people by not giving them 100% of what it is that I'm capable of doing. It may not be 100% from the day before, but it's 100% of what I have at that time. So I focus on my story that I have created that may not have anything to do with the words that I'm saying. And I literally take a big writing tablet, huge, like an artist's tablet. And I write out the verse and all the words, and then I have who I am, how old I am, where do I live, what era, what am I wearing, who am I singing to, why am I saying this, what do my parents do for a living, do I have a brother, do I have sisters, do I have children, am I a kid, an old person, and I create a story that I believe. So when it's kind of like once you've wired up the house, you don't have to keep rewiring it.
Right, right.
You just turn on the light. Mm-hmm. So that's when you practice like that, and you know, I was taught this way, and I thought my teacher was just nuts, and but she wasn't, because this is actually the way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I've had phenomenal teachers, and I listened to her, but that worked for me, so I don't get stage fright. What I do get is a sense of connecting at my heart to other people's hearts, and they can only hear you one heart at a time. So I don't get nervous, no matter how big or small the group, because it's just one heart at a time. And so I just imagine myself having a conversation with them, but I'm telling them in an ardent speech, which is what singing is. I feel it so deeply that I have to sing it to you. And it's really beautiful. It's very intoxicating and quite addictive. And I can't even tell you what I did when I get off stage, because I'll turn and ask, you know, my manager or my husband, whoever's there, I'll say, or my agent or publicist, was it okay? Okay. I have no idea.
Yeah. Well,
have no idea.
It's interesting, the descriptions that you provide, because as a kid growing up, I used to watch every once in a while on Sundays was movie day and at the house when I was a kid growing up. And my folks, they'd turn on whatever channel it was, and that back then there were only 3 or 5 channels, and they were watching, invariably they were watching a musical. Mm-hmm. And if I was going to watch TV, that's what I was going to watch.
Uh-huh.
If I wasn't going to watch TV, I was going to leave the room, because they were not going to tolerate a kid sitting there yammering about how dumb this was or this or that or the other. I watched so many of them that after a while I started to think, wouldn't life be really neat if there were songs that accompanied various activities and things that you were doing throughout your day? I used to think and imagine and even hear music, you know, sort of as I was going through my day. But I want to touch upon something. I want to touch upon something that you alluded to, and you may not even be aware that you brought it up. The act of self-deprecation is rather interesting, and a lot of people do not know that they do it. Mm-hmm. I am very conscious of the fact that I do not, because I do not want to. Mm-hmm. In radio, you never draw attention to a problem that's happening. If, for example, in the middle of this interview, and we're still able to continue recording because the computers and the console and the microphones all have backup power, but the lights go out in the room, neither you nor the listeners will know that, because I am not going to say one word about it because it's irrelevant. But you made a comment about your old CDs that this person shared with your producer. And I'm wondering how that perspective, I know that it's changed over time. It's, you know, but my God, the music that you are making, people love it. You have to, have you come to a place where you can at least say in response to somebody's glowing review, thank you?
Oh, yes, I have. I know exactly the comment when I said the crummy CDs I made in my basement.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not production quality. They weren't demo tape quality. Mm-hmm. They were just some folk things that I did. And I thought, that's good enough.
Right.
Well, what Barry taught me, and I knew it from prior experience, was that people remember you for the worst thing that you've done. And they will recall, oh, don't you remember that stinkeroo, whatever? You know, social network is just that. It's social, and everybody remembers. And they're going to find it. So those things are archived in a file, in a mayonnaise jar under a Funkin' Wagnall under the porch. Nobody, that stuff never surfacing. It will never see the light of day.
Right.
But I one of the things that my voice teacher taught me, I was very fortunate when I had taken a hiatus from singing to address some issues with family, so I had to take some time off, and that's typically not a wise move to make career wise, but I had no choice. My family comes first, so I took some time off, and then when I got back into singing, I wanted to get my teacher didn't have any room in her studio, so it's really hard to get a teacher. You have to audition, and there has to be a rapport, and they have to have a spot for you, and then you have to be able to afford it, and it's at a time that you can go, and it's really not an easy thing. So I had the opportunity to meet this woman named Maria Farnworth in New York, and she's called the Fix-It Lady. And I had developed some poor vocal habits, and I knew it, and I didn't quite know how to remedy them, so I went to her, and I said, oh, that's terrible. And she said, oh, no, you have to leave that person outside the door. We're only positive in this studio. Mm. That needs improvement. And so she said, "You and you're not able to do it yet." And she completely changed my way of thinking about the way I was singing, because I would say, oh, I can't hit that note. And she would say, yet. You must add possibility, and yet. So then when we would review, I had to film every voice lesson. She said, you got to get used to being in front of the camera, because they're going to be up your goozle, and you just can't be bothered by them, because that's what you do.
Right.
And everybody's going to be filming everything. And this was a long time before people were doing that. So she said, this is where it's going. And so I would have to analyze my lessons and then come in with a piece of paper with a line down the middle, each verse, everything written out. And the columns were, sounds good, needs improvement, but never this sucks ever. And which it truly, and she said, because it's like, it's, you wouldn't say to a little child who's taken a step, okay, I want you to run a race. You know, you idiot, why can't you do that? And when you're talking about your singer is a very delicate little child.
Yeah.
And you have to be very kind.
Oh.
And it's the same for any instrumentalist, any performer. That's like a little child. It's a little flower. So if I'm mean to me, can you, you know, then it's never going to, I'm never going to improve, because who's going to improve with that negative input?
And I think,
and so, yeah.
And I think that that may be one of the very reasons why I have never actively pursued any kind of an attempt at even soloing. I remember back in, and I forget what the year was, but I recorded a series of 8 or 10 or 12 Christmas songs. I was able to manipulate the vocals out of the music. I had the technical wherewithal to do that, and I sang to, I had that as my background music, and it just worked out well, and I created this cassette that I gave to people around the holidays that particular year.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember some of the reactions were favorable. They were positive. One woman that I knew, she was actually the general manager of the station, the very first station that I ever worked for. She says, "You sound an awful lot like, now I can't remember his name. I can, Chances Are is the name of the song, Johnny Mathis."
Oh, nice.
Okay, which I thought, okay, well, I like him, and okay, I can take that. Two comments made by one of my siblings. I won't mention whom, but nonetheless, and you're right. It's like, man, I don't know if I want to put myself through that. And it is epitomized in a song by one of my favorite artists, late Harry Chapin, a song called Mr. Tanner. And he basically, he's just working in a cleaning shop, and he's just singing to himself. And his friends and family keep working on him. Hey, you need to pursue this full time. I mean, you got a great voice, baritone, just beautiful. And he had this great singer in his band, Harry did, that used to do the part and fall on your knees, da 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 da. And he goes to New York and he spends almost all of his savings, and he gets there and everything's ready, and he gets up there and it's like a blur, and he sings, and the review comes back and it is just devastating. And he slinks back to his cleaner shop back in the Midwest, and he never sings again except very late at night when the shop is dark and closed.
Uh-huh.
And he sings softly to himself as he sorts through the clothes.
Uh-huh.
And then they have that very soft fall on your knees. Oh, here,
yep.
And then, of course, the Harry does the line, music was his life. It was not his livelihood. And I think that a lot of musicians don't pursue that career because that child inside, they already went through their first childhood and it wasn't that great in the first place. And now they're an adult body, but that child is still in there going, don't okay. you do that to me.
Yeah,
you'll make me cry.
Well, you find a person, a mentor, and you find someone whose criticism is always constructive and well-intended, because
yeah.
he, she knows what you're capable of doing and is always looking for you to make improvement so that you can handle it. And other people are going to just make comments. I've had, people say that Simon Cowell is so mean.
Yeah.
He's not. He's a pussycat. And in the real world,
that's a show.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
a show. But in the real world, they're not that polite. And I remember my first big audition in New York, and I was brought up from Texas, and I came up, I did a lot of 20th century music, contemporary music, but classical. And so, you know, Stravinsky, Dalla Piccola, Webern, you know, really, you know, very challenging music, because I have a good ear. And I speak lots of languages, and I just love all this stuff. And so I was asked to come up to sing for a particular person, I will never say this person's name, who was going to be on tour but had to miss a portion of the tour. And so I happened to know that repertoire. So I came up, and I sang for this person. Well, I had no idea who this person was as a person. I only know who this person was as an artist, so I was very honored to be asked. So the pianist who was playing for me these very difficult pieces came in and sat down, and he proceeded to have a nervous breakdown, started crying, and ran off the stage. So this is not what I was really hoping for. And the person said, "You sit down and play," which is not typical. And so I did, and I went through 7 songs, which is unheard of. Typically in an audition, you'll get about a minute if you're really lucky. And if they say, what else do you have? Start there, like second section, and they're very matter-of-fact. So I sang through 7 complete songs, and I'm playing these accompaniments that sound like a cat in heat. You know, it's really hard stuff. So I finished, and I stood up, and this person said, it's apparent that you have you've got an incredible ear, and you have a beautiful voice, and obviously you have nerves of steel. But I hate watching you sing. You're just so ugly. You make me want to vomit. Get out. Get out. And I said, thank you so much. I walked out. I'm like, what did I do? So I went. I had to go sing for somebody else because I'd set up all these auditions. So I, you know, basically had sweat rings under my arms, you know, down to my hips because I just broke. I started perspiring. I've never had anybody speak to me that way. You know, and it was awful. And I walked in, and this gentleman says, did you just go sing for so-and-so? And I said, uh-huh. He goes, you look like the person that this person's significant other just ran off with.
Oh.
I'm sure that this person hated you. And I said, oh, that would explain it. Oh, my God. And I never, like, really? He goes, I'm really sorry. It must have been pretty bad. And I told him what happened. He says, your pianist what? I said, he started crying. He got up and ran out of the room. It was, and I was brought up for that one, you know. That, like, wow. That was my invitation. And I had other auditions where I was up for a part, and I went to go on to the inside, and a girl walks by and just threw a Coca-Cola all over me. And I was in a white dress, so I came, and I had it all over my face and hair and down my blouse and on my white skirt. And I walked in, and I said, I'm just sorry the woman tripped. And they said, I'm sorry, sweetheart, but we don't have another time to hear you. Just sing. And I sang, covered in Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what you do.
Yeah.
It's really hard. I got the part.
Yeah.
But it's really hard. So you have to have pretty much nerves of steel. So you look at it as a performance. You get an opportunity to sing for people, and then you leave.
Extraordinary.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
And but if you do find a mentor who can give you the constructive criticism and only has your best interest at heart, and there's, you know, someone in the profession whose career you really admire, then you're able to withstand nasty reviews or when they say something, like, you know, really awful. Because if you leave the good stuff, then you're going to have to listen to the bad stuff too. So you have to just find one person, and as well as yourself, to believe enough in yourself.
Exactly.
So
Well, before we wrap up the program, and I preface this every time I do this, just because the guest never knows this, the listeners have heard this numerous times, and are probably sick and tired of hearing it. But I have 3 basic questions to wrap up the program that I would like to ask. The first one is, who is Elisa Brown?
Who is Elisa Brown? She's she's an artist, and she's a mother, and she's a wife and a daughter and a sister and a friend.
And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I really want to connect people to the arts because people have a sense, people live in a chaotic environment, and we all are searching to belong to something, and really what we need, we have it right within us, and music can bridge can cut through the chaos and connect us to our hearts and to our sense of our own divinity and our humanity that exists with all of us. So that's really, I mean, it's a pretty noble mission, but that is my mission.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
Oh, I do believe that we can accomplish whatever we put our minds and hearts to. If we're sincere and we create a mindset, you know, I know you said make a plan and God laughs, but I think that you allow things to blossom and unfold, but you set the intention of this is where I want to go, and I'm going to allow myself to get there in the way that is for the highest and best for myself and for everyone else involved. And I do believe that, because I know it for myself, that you can create something out of absolutely nothing. is you just you trust and believe.
Ooh, that's good. Matter of fact, that epitomizes the process that we took on in February of 2006, when both my wife and I had lost both of our jobs, and she said, it feels like we're on a precipice, and I'm scared. I don't know what to do. And, of course, I'd been doing interviews like this for years up to that point, and I'd been through personal growth programs, and I'd read books, and on and on and on. I says, well, the one message that's clear that comes through all of that is that when you're on the edge of a cliff, you do two things. You jump, and you trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it comes down to. And I thank you for jumping and trusting in this interview. And I'm thankful for the fact that you've taken time out of your day to share with us. And hopefully we can hear more of you and from you in the coming years.
Oh, I am so grateful for this opportunity. And thank you for letting me just chat away about my passion, which is music, and for sharing your stories with me as well. I really enjoyed this hour. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And part of your sharing is inspiring others as well who struggle through some of the same things that you did. Hey, look at Elisa, look where she is now. Look at what she's creating now. You can do the same thing if you want to, and we encourage folks to check out your website, which is elisabrownmusic.com. That's elisabrownmusic.com. And again, Elisa, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at the same time, love to Lal.